This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The men and women who serve in our military and their families face a variety of challenges and changes in their lives during active duty time and after service members return from deployment and reintegrate back into more normal routines. Joining us to talk about working with members of our armed forces, veterans and their families, and how to treat the physical and mental health issues that can result from military service are Susan McIlvain, clinical social worker in the Cincinnati VA Medical Center's PTSD Traumatic Brain Injury Residential Program, and Dr. Gary Dick, a therapist and professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Social Work and editor of the book Social Work Practice with Veterans. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Susan and Gary, thank you both for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Gary, put this in perspective for me. I always look at this in terms of the major stresses that service members and their families undergo. It's during deployment. Much of it's actually during deployment, but it's a lot more than that, isn't it? This is actually a cycle.
Exactly, Mark. Not only is the service member under stress who's serving in the military, but the entire family system really serves and is under that kind of stress. And I think that in pulling together the book, one of the things I learned very quickly is the whole entire family system is affected by a service member being deployed. And in the stages of deployment, you have the pre-deployment stage where service members getting ready to leave home. Then you've got the active deployment stage, and then, of course, the post-deployment. And that's where, as Susan will talk about, we know so much about the PTSD, the after effects of serving in a war zone.
Now, there are even stresses surrounding signing up for service.
Exactly. A lot of times, and we've got a chapter about this in the book, looking at what we call the theoretical perspectives on why people join the military. And it's not just to serve one's country and to perform that kind of duty. That's an admirable, noble cause. But there's what we call content issues, which have to deal with individual issues within the individual. And there's also what we call more process issues, where a number of dynamics are merging together that motivate one to serve in the military.
So what motivated this study about the well-being of veterans from the perspective of the social worker?
Okay, a couple years ago, NASW, the National Association of Social Workers, which is the national organization for professional social workers across the U.S., had joined forces with the White House. And it was really a call to duty for the social work profession. And NASW decided to set some standards and practices about service members, veterans, and military families. And so the whole focus was to set evidence-based practice standards to work with military families. And again, not just the military service member, but the military families. So out of that, out of those standards that were developed, I felt like that the social work profession, the schools of social work across the country, really did not have a comprehensive book that really dealt with the issues of military life from a family systems perspective. And so we wanted to include issues related to military children, military fathers, the stages of deployment, what happens when there's been an amputation, theoretical perspectives on joining the military, plus all the mental health issues that come out of the trauma of serving in the war.
And you've got a personal interest in this too, right?
Yeah, actually, this goes way, way back. One of my grandfathers, John Dick, served in the Revolutionary War, and he fought at the Battle of Moultrie in Charleston, and actually was wounded. He was also captured by the British and returned. And throughout my family history, every grandfather has served in the military up to the Vietnam War.
Susan, how do you view this research and the study and everything that went into this book? How important is this in improving things for treating veterans and service members?
Incredibly important. As more and more people enter the social work schools and learning how to treat veterans, their issues, learning how to understand post-traumatic stress disorder, to not only give the veteran expert treatment, but also look at the family and the children.
Is this a growing area in social work?
Well, we do have a couple schools across the country. The University of Southern California actually has a major in military social work. And the University of Cincinnati, the School of Social Work and the College of Allied Health Sciences, is developing a certificate program where those master-level social workers that have graduated can come back and go through several courses to become more competent in working with veterans and their families.
But this is being recognized as an area that there's going to be a greater and greater need for working with these veterans.
Absolutely, and we want to be on the cutting edge and be ready to serve.
Gary, if you compare past wars that America's been involved in, how have our attitudes toward veterans and helping them with the mental and the physical issues they face, how have these changed over the years?
Well, social work has actually been working with veterans going back to World War I. In 1918, the Army and Navy hospitals, for the very first time, hired and placed in the hospitals trained professional social workers. And I think today, one of the things we really wanted to always look at, I think this is something that social work really, a perspective that we've always embraced, is looking at the person within the social environment, that our historical and our cultural context really helps to understand and define human behavior.
They're not just operating in isolation, then.
Absolutely. Okay. And so when we go back and we look at the Vietnam War, for example, and we talked about this in the book, that in 1969, 89%, 88% of the service members were draftees. And the Vietnam War, and just if you take 1968, there were almost 17,000 losses, casualties. And in May of 1970, 59% of the American public thought that we should not send troops into Vietnam. In 1985, 74% of the public didn't. So whenever we go to war, it's always important to understand public opinion. And yet in 2003, when the global war on terrorism began, 76% of Americans thought that we supported the war. And regardless of one's position on should we be in Iraq or not, the social work profession, regardless of their personal ideologies, is there to support the military families.
If I could just add to what you said, Gary, I think one of the unique things about social work as a discipline is that it concentrates on meeting a veteran or a client where they are. So unlike psychiatry, psychology, which deals with mental health issues or primary care physicians, social work looks at everything in a person's environment, biology, psychology, social implications, economic implications, family systems, just meeting the person where they are, which I think is unique in terms of a profession and a discipline.
Susan, what are the mental health issues related to veterans who've been traumatized by combat? I mean, it's a lot of different things, isn't it, that they face?
Absolutely. The biggest thing in my field, obviously, is treating post-traumatic stress disorder. But what comes with that are comorbid disorders. We see a lot of veterans with PTSD who suffer from depression, also substance use disorders, alcohol use disorders, opioid use disorders. As you know, there's a huge heroin epidemic in this country, and we're seeing that numbers rising in veteran populations as well. Bipolar disorder is another disorder that is common in, or can be common in veteran populations.
So how do you define post-traumatic stress disorder? That's the one everybody always hears about, but what exactly is that?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder that is an anxiety-based disorder, but the defining characteristic of PTSD is that a trauma had to have occurred in the person's life.
Now, what kind of symptoms do you see with this? How does somebody recognize that? I'm a family member. I'm worried about, you know, my returning service member. How do I recognize this?
You recognize it by symptoms that are re-experiencing. A person might re-experience unwanted memories of the traumatic event while they're awake, nightmares, flashbacks, extreme psychological distress when something reminds them of the trauma, or psychological distress. There's hypervigilance, where a person is easily startled. They're on guard all the time, looking over their shoulder, a lot of hypervigilance, trouble sleeping, having irritability, go to 0 to 100 in anger in very few seconds, an inability to concentrate. You also have a lot of negative thoughts about yourself, perhaps, or the world. And what I mean by that is thinking that you're no good, that you're not worth anything, or that other people can't be trusted, or the world isn't safe. Very strong negative cognitions.
So there were hypervigilance. There was an article around the 4th of July that came out that talked about how many veterans, the fireworks are just not a good experience. So there's a lot of truth in that.
Absolutely. It's a really tough time of year for veterans. Those loud fireworks or loud noises as such really serve as triggers for these folks.
Gary, do we have any idea how many people suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder from their military service?
Mark, in 2012, the Office of the Surgeon General reported that there were 103,792 new cases of PTSD. There were also 253,330 cases of TBI, traumatic brain injury. In addition, there were over 1,715 amputations and 332 suicides.
Susan, when did we start recognizing PTSD? If you go back in history, I think World War I, they talked about shell shock. There's references to battle fatigue. But when did we first diagnose this and classify this as a specific disorder?
PTSD was first diagnosed in the DSM in 1980 and was listed as post-traumatic stress disorder. It had been observed by the medical community prior to that, but not called post-traumatic stress disorder. And we know, even back in very early times, Japanese warriors, even in 1666, Samuel Pepys wrote in his diary about after the Great Fire in London, having symptoms that were very similar to post-traumatic stress disorder, what we know of it today.
So it's been around for a long time. We just hadn't named it yet.
We hadn't named it.
And it's interesting, too, you hear stories about earlier wars where veterans returned, they came back, and family members says there's just something not quite right. They don't seem like themselves anymore. We didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these former soldiers, they lived lives of quiet desperation, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. We'll continue talking with Gary Dick and Susan McElvain after this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and my guest this afternoon, Susan McElvain, clinical social worker in the Cincinnati VA Medical Center's PTSD Traumatic Brain Injury Residential Program. and Dr. Gary Dick, a therapist and professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Social Work and editor of the book Social Work Practice with Veterans. 513-419-7100 to join our conversation. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gary had mentioned TBI, traumatic brain injury. Well, what does that cover, Susan?
Well, traumatic brain injury is what we know today as the signature injury of these current conflicts that we are facing in, at the time. And these traumatic brain injuries are difficult. First of all, let me say that there are various classifications of traumatic brain injury. They're mild, moderate, and severe. And the classifications are really based on the amount of time that a person was lost of consciousness or they had traumatic amnesia. But the issue we're seeing is, and the numbers are staggering, between 15 and 30% of military personnel are returning or in deployed with a history of a mild traumatic brain injury. What the problem is we're not able to assess this in the battlefield. There is really no assessment going on because, in a combat theater, it's not easy to take a time out and go get assessed for a traumatic brain injury. So some of these go undiagnosed. In addition, you know, some get their, you know, face an IED explosion or an RPG attack and don't want to report it. They feel like they're fine. It's okay. Let's not report it. Let's get back out there. So, you know, there's a multitude of issues of why some of these go unreported.
Are they? Is this both a mental and a physical issue?
Not necessarily. A mild traumatic brain injury does have, it can overlap symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is what, you know, we do in the program where I work. We're treating veterans that have a history of traumatic brain injury as well as PTSD. And some of those overlapping symptoms are trouble with memory, trouble sleeping, irritability, loss of motivation. And those are all things that we can see within the diagnosis of PTSD as well.
Gary, you know, considering what happened in Chattanooga, there has to be this additional stress right now of just having a family member who's in the service. You know, knowing that they can be targets even here at home. Plus, there's the idea you're always waiting around for the possible deployment to happen, that other shoe to drop, for that loved one to be sent off to a combat area. Those are additional stresses on the family, aren't they?
Absolutely, Mark. And I think that one of the things that we learned in the book, we were doing an interview with a couple, and he was deployed to Iraq, and his wife really wanted to join a support group because of, you know, the knock on the door, the phone call. And he really discouraged her from that. He did not want her to be in a group with a bunch of other military wives hearing their stories. He thought that would upset her. And when he returned, he was having a lot of problems. He was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. She recognized it, that he had changed. But she would say, "What's going on? How are you feeling? What are you thinking? What went on over there?" He didn't want to talk about it. And as we were doing the interviews with them, one of the things we realized was he was trying to protect her. He didn't want her to worry while he was there. He didn't want her to know what was going on with him. And that was his way of being protective. But at the same time, she was really trying to help him get help. And as well, their little boy was recognizing that daddy's different.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Scott in Norwood. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had heard some discussion a while ago about potentially dropping the D from PTSD because post-traumatic stress would be a natural condition of any war. It's a grisly experience, and stress is unfortunate. Flashbacks and everything are unfortunate, but the word disorder has kind of a stigma to it, and it's not, I have heard that it's not necessarily a disorder. It's not that there's anything wrong with these people. It's just that they're experiencing a natural consequence of war.
Yes, I appreciate your call. Yes, that is, I have heard that as well. Nothing official has come out about that from the APA or the the National Society for Post-Traumatic Stress, but I have heard that they are trying to remove the word disorder, and it seems apparent because, you know, the stigma with mental health, you know, if you to getting help, if you think you have a disorder, it may preclude you from coming forward and getting help.
Mark, I really agree with you. I think that any traumatic event under the right circumstances, any of us could experience trauma, and therefore it would be a very normative reaction to that stressor. So disorder, again, you know, it makes it more of a negative mental health issue. There's something wrong with you.
Now, can a person recover from PTSD?
Yes, a person can learn how to cope with their post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD, as I mentioned, comes about after having experienced a trauma. So we don't tell patients that, you know, you can be cured of post-traumatic stress disorder because we cannot take the trauma away. But we can teach you skills and habits to learn how to cope with your anxieties, and so they take up less of your life. And so in that way, we can help you learn how to think differently so as you're not dwelling on the past.
Well, what are some of the ways you help people cope with this?
Well, the VA has endorsed gold standards of treatment. And what we use in the program where I work is cognitive processing therapy. And we also offer prolonged exposure therapy, along with some other therapies that are approved and effective to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. But those two are the signature gold standards of treatment for post-traumatic stress.
Now, what about traumatic brain injuries? What's the prognosis for somebody with those? I guess it depends on the level, mild, moderate, or severe.
It does indeed. And people that have traumatic brain injuries can learn compensatory strategies to help them overcome the deficits that they may have incurred from their brain injury. Every brain injury is different in how it affects the person. So, for example, we have patients work with speech therapists, occupational therapists, to help learn different ways to cope with perhaps their memory difficulties or their executive functioning skills. And what I mean by that is learning that if you have a doctor's appointment and you have to be in Clifton at 3:30, you need a half hour to travel there, you're going to need to schedule all this time in your calendar to know when you have to get ready, when you have to leave, to remember to take your prescriptions with you, or just executive functioning like that. Speech therapists and occupational therapists can do wonders with veterans in helping them learn how to compensate for those deficits.
Do you use a lot of peer-to-peer counseling? Vets talking to other vets as support groups? How beneficial is that?
Absolutely. The VA has implemented a peer support program that we have veterans who have been through our program and have received post-traumatic stress disorder treatment, and they are on board on our team to help provide education, to help give support to veterans because they've walked in their shoes.
Mm-hmm. Is it effective, Gary?
Absolutely. One of the values and one of the therapeutic factors of being in a support group is what we call universality. And when you find out that you're not the only one that experienced that, that felt that, or thought that, somehow you feel the sense of community of your peers.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And, you know, you were talking earlier, Gary, about motivations for enlisting. You know, this is such a life-altering experience. What are the motivations? Why do people enlist in the military?
Well, I think most of us, the first thing that comes to mind is we think of the duty to serve. We're citizens of the United States of America, and we want to protect and defend freedom. And that's certainly an important, significant motivation for people. Another one, I mean, if we even go back and think about John F. Kennedy in 1961, his inaugural address, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I think that's a great example of the duty to serve. And I think in so many ways, when NASW developed their standards for social work practice with military families, it was the social work profession's way of saying, we're here to serve, we're here to do our duty. Another one is personal growth. I mean, think of the character building, the sense of discipline, the organizational skills, the managerial skills, that sense of brotherhood and teamwork that comes from being a service member. And there's also economic reasons. You know, people may not be able to find employment, and they join because they're going to have a paycheck, and then the post-military benefits are fantastic.
Now, has there been research done on how this affects children?
Absolutely. One of the things that we wanted to talk about in the book is, you know, how does the military impact children? And if we look at some of the statistics, and this was kind of shocking for all of us, there were 4,889 military children who lost a parent in the war. There's 73% of the children, their parent has served one term, one tour duty. But yet 48% have served several times. And so what happens, I think, when we look at military children, we also have to look at military fathers. And this had been something that had really been, I don't want to say ignored, but it had not been at the forefront of looking at military families. And so if your child is born and 2 months later you're shipped off to Afghanistan, that father has not had time to bond with that child. And I was interviewing a gentleman from Meigs County down in southeastern Ohio. He was in the Marine Corps. And we were talking about fathers and military children, and I had mentioned that one of the painful experiences for many military fathers is if they leave their children when they're very young and they come back, the children don't know them. And he looked at me and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, barely able to hear him, he said, that's what happened to him. And he said, he'd been, I think, 3 tours of duty, and he said, of all the traumatic things that he experienced, the most traumatic was coming back and his child not knowing him.
Mm-hmm. And Susan, this can create mental health issues for the child as well, can it?
Absolutely. Wow. I worked with a family who, little son of first grade age, was having extreme problems with anxiety and just constantly worried that his dad was going to leave again once he was home. Caused a great amount of stress on the family.
Now, can children be diagnosed with PTSD because of the experience, this whole thing?
Of their father serving in the military or mother serving in the military? That they probably would have, it probably wouldn't be PTSD, more of an anxiety-related disorder. Okay. Although, and I'm not saying it wouldn't be traumatic.
One of the things we found out was that there is probably very, very little research on military children who have lost a parent. You know, how do they cope? How do they deal with the loss? Just recently, with Fernside's camp for grieving children, one of the counselors was sharing with me that for the very first time, you know, they always have children in those groups where a parent has committed suicide. And they were telling me that this time, for the first time, they had 3 children in the camp whose fathers were in the military who committed suicide. And he said one of the little boys looked up and said, this just doesn't seem fair.
Now, how much study has been done on women in the military, Gary?
A lot. It's been, I think we looked at this and we did not, there were several chapters that we wanted to have in the book that we couldn't. We had first turned in a draft of 650 pages, and the editor said, no, we really meant it when we wanted 350. And our chapter on women in the military was cut. But one of the things I think we have to look at in terms of women in the military is, again, their motivation for serving. And then how, if they have families, what kinds of, in pre-deployment stages, what kinds of plans have been set in place to care for those children? Who has legal custody to take the child to the doctor, to make those kinds of decisions? If the father is available and he's there to do it, that's one thing. But there are many women in the military where the husbands are also serving an active duty. And so all these plans have to be made for the children who have been left stateside.
And have we done research on fatherhood as far?
Actually, it's one of the things we're wanting to do.
Yeah, and there's not been enough of that done, I take it.
Not at all. There was one study that we did that we looked at that was actually fabulous. And what they did is they interviewed about 78 men located throughout the world that were serving in active duty. And one of the things they looked at is how did these service members stay in touch with their children? And they found that there were some fathers who could Skype and be on the phone every day, and they were fine. They liked seeing their kid ride the bicycle for the first time. Yet there were other fathers who just totally turned over and relinquished all parenting to the mother and stepped aside. Some men reported that it was way too painful for them to talk to their kid on a video when they were trying to survive in a military war zone. And so because it was so painful, they would just disengage and have infrequent contact.
Well, and it has to be painful, too. You leave a child who's 12 years old, you come back, they're 14 or so, and it's just like going back to square one, isn't it?
Exactly. At 12, they're going to McDonald's with you. At 14, they want to be with their peers. And that was one of the focuses that we wanted to put in this book, was that as humans, we go through a life cycle. We go through psychological, social stages of development. So not only do the children, a big difference between 12 and 14, but so does the fathers. And I think one of the things we were looking at in terms of deployment is that many of these service members they're young. I think the average age is about 26, and they're just getting into intimate relationships, which is a major task of young adulthood. How do you manage an intimate relationship? And at the same time, they're also being trained in military life. Totally two different focuses there on how to cope and deal in the world.
We'll continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss working with members of our armed forces, veterans and their families, and how to treat the physical and mental health issues that can result from military service are Susan McElvain, clinical social worker in the Cincinnati VA Medical Center's PTSD Traumatic Brain Injury Residential Program, and Dr. Gary Dick, a therapist and professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Social Work, and editor of the book Social Work Practice with Veterans. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Susan, we were talking earlier about fireworks as a trigger for veterans who are suffering from PTSD. What are some of the other stressors? I mean, frustrating situations, dealing with coworkers, someone being argumentative, or those things that can cause problems as well?
Absolutely. Loud noises, car exhaust bangings. Oftentimes, veterans will report having trouble driving because if they see any litter on the side of the road, it's an immediate flashback that could be an explosive device on the side of the road.
Wow.
So I hear that a lot.
Yeah, so it's okay. It can be anything, pretty much.
Anything.
Yeah.
I was a couple summers ago, I was with a friend of mine who served as a physician in the Vietnam War and who suffers from PTSD. And we had gone out to a winery in Brown County, and the kids there that lived there were riding a little vehicle. And the noise from that vehicle reminded him of the sounds from the war in Vietnam, of helicopters flying over. And suddenly he screamed and jumped up and said, "Gary, hit the ground, hit the ground." And he dove on the ground face down and had his hands over his head. And I realized instantly that he was having a post-traumatic stress disorder. And so there are a number of things that can trigger a reaction. It could even be the smell of something, or it could be the color of one's clothing, the cloud formations. It just really depends on what they experienced at the time of the trauma.
And Susan, it sounds like they've become conditioned because of what they've been through.
Right. And to Gary's point, sensory perceptions are huge stimulators of memory and oftentimes trigger. It can be anything, smells, just like you said, sounds, touch, the feel of something, taste.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Katie in Northern Kentucky. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I am a military spouse. But my question today is about an experience that a friend of ours had. She is a serving mother, and at the very beginning of the Iraq War, was not planning on having children, but ended up pregnant just prior to orders to be deployed. And they scheduled her early for a cesarean section with the plans of sending her as soon as the child was 6 weeks old for her deployment. They did do that, and she was there for 18 months and came home with some facial injuries because she was in an IED explosion. Mm. It took her 6 months after her return home to regain custody of her child because of her injuries. And then 6 months after getting her child back, who didn't even know her, she was deployed for another year. And in the end of that period of time, she actually lost permanent custody of her child because the new judge felt that the child no longer knew her at all. And so she just has the child on weekends. And fast forward 10 years, I'm just curious, how often is this kind of thing happening to young mothers, whether they're single or they have spouses who also serve?
Katie, thanks for your call. That sounds really a horrible story. You know, I haven't heard a lot of female veterans reporting losing custody of their children, but again, I'm only one person. I'm sure she's getting legal advice, but I would, encourage her to try to get as much legal advice as she can. And we have, at the VA, we have a Veterans Justice Outreach Division, and she can get in touch with an outreach coordinator to try to help her if she needs additional legal advice or assistance.
You know, we're talking a lot about, how you treat this after the fact. But are there things that we can be doing that we should be working on ahead of time?
Well, I think during the pre-deployment stage, there are so many things that need to be talked about. For example, a will, money, if there's property, whose name is that property in? And what happens if you don't return? And these are very, very difficult issues to talk about. But yet, if they're not talked about, if they're not given a voice, they're always those dynamic issues right below the surface that are creating anxiety and depression. And like in Katie's situation with her friend, that is a tremendous loss for that mother as well as for the child. The whole bonding process has been disrupted because of deployment and then multiple deployments. So, I think Susan coined it best. What a tragic, horrible story to hear.
513-419-7100 to join us. And Bob called, and he wanted to know if the draft would make a difference, volunteer versus drafted. Has there been any research done on that to show the difference in attitudes?
Well, first of all, yes, there has been. If you look at high school seniors who say they want to serve in the military, about 77% of them go on and serve in the military, where they say, this is my goal. If we go back and look at the Vietnam War, in 1968, when we had a huge number of casualties, 16,899, I can remember in 1968, no one wanted to be drafted. And President Nixon, you know, did the selective service, and so everyone had a number. And, you know, when we were seeing the caskets come off of the planes every evening on the news, no one wanted to go off and fight in the jungles of Vietnam War, the Vietnam War. And yet, when you look at after 9/11, you know, the duty to serve was very high. We were attacked, and people wanted to serve in the military. Today, we don't have a draft.
Now, has there ever been any research on service members who were never deployed in danger zones, but they still had trouble going back to civilian life?
I don't know about official research, but I have had patients who have had non-deployable traumatic events that occurred in whether in boot camp or just stateside service. Absolutely.
Yeah, because we talk about it's complicated. We talk about what they go through before deployment and during deployment, but then when they come back, that's a lot of change all of a sudden. You've been used to this regimented, ordered life, and now you come back to the kind of messy life that real life can be, and it's hard to make that change, isn't it, Gary?
Well, absolutely, Mark. And you've got also this group dynamic that goes on when you're in, you know, with your buddies in the military. You're there to look after them. A lot of times men that have been injured don't want to return to the United States to recover because they're leaving their buddies behind. So there's this really intense sense of we-ness that comes from being in the military. And then you come back and you're a family man.
The other thing I commonly hear is when soldiers come home, they are looking for that adrenaline rush replacement because they are operating day to day with that high adrenaline in relation to conflicts or responding to conflicts, and they're trying to replace that. And sometimes it gets replaced in unhealthy ways, or some people find healthy ways to replace it, but it is a big concern or a big void when they come home and replacing that adrenaline rush.
It's I think you refer to it as a complicated adjustment. Is that the way you talk about it?
Adjustments.
Yeah, it is indeed, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, very much so.
Now, how big, Susan, are the issues of drug abuse and homelessness among veterans? You know, this making this return, readjusting is tough, and they run into this a lot, don't they?
Absolutely, and as you know, President Obama made it part of his platform to end homelessness among the veteran population, and also drug abuse as well. I mean, we're seeing very high rates of veterans who are using heroin, alcohol abuse, crack cocaine abuse. I mean, drug addiction or medicating with alcohol and drugs is a common comorbid disorder with post-traumatic stress.
What about incarceration? How much do they face problems with the criminal justice system?
You know, that's a problem as well, and the VA has done a great job responding in terms of setting up veteran justice outreach coordinators in VAs across the country to help veterans deal with judicial issues.
Gary, are newer vets, are they still joining organizations that allow them to share their experiences? That has to be a healing thing. If you can be part of a group of people who've been through the same thing, you can share, like the VFW, other groups. Is that still common these days among the newer vets?
I think to some extent it is, Mark. I think we've all got to realize that even though there could be a lot of support, a lot of sharing, to be able to still care for other military service members could be a great benefit psychologically. But also, there's some folks that want to detach, and they want to close doors, and they want to leave that behind them, and they don't want to join up. They want to be reintegrated back, and they want to really put that, almost compartmentalize it in a healthy way and put it behind them, and yet take the great benefits that come from discipline and from being organized and from being, you know, learning the respect for the chain of command, if you will. So in many ways, there's a lot of organizations. There's one called OutServe that serves gay military family members. And so with the internet and online resources, there's an abundance of available information just over the internet that offers support and information.
Well, you mentioned gay family members. Don't ask, don't tell. What has been the effect of repealing that?
Well,
that's something you looked into as well,
yeah,
right?
We had a whole chapter on gays in the military. And prior to President Obama repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you could not be openly gay in the military, and yet the military had several gay, had many gay family members, service members in the military. And what we wanted to do is we were kind of like, well, we were curious about what would that be like to be gay in the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell? And we did some interviews with a female Marine out in California and a sailor from Ohio. And one of the things that we found was not only was it overt discrimination, but the level of abuse that went on in the military when other bullies, so to speak, decided that they wanted to intimidate and threaten people and actually physically assault them. And one of the interviews that we did, it was extremely traumatic, secondary trauma we call it, to hear the story. But the person was talking about during this process of being intimidated how they were afraid to walk on the ship at night because they thought a particular small group of people were going to throw them overboard. And to have that kind of fear while you're serving your country, you know, we look at this now and we say this was ridiculous, just totally ridiculous. And of course, that's changed, and the Department of Defense and the Secretary of Defense, they've been extremely progressive in terms of advocating for multiple rights for gay military service members and their families.
And as we've seen recently, this whole issue is ever evolving and changing rapidly, isn't it?
Absolutely, with the Supreme Court's ruling on nationwide gay marriage and public opinion and the changes there. It's I think Hillary Clinton, when she spoke in December of 2010 at the human rights meeting in Geneva, talked about gay rights as human rights, and very respectfully really encouraged the world body, as she said, to stand on the right side of history.
Does any branch of the service have any type of mental psychological training during basic training to help these recruits better adjust, or is it all physical? They just throw them out there and say, suck it up and learn to be a soldier?
You know, I'm not certain of what the various branches of the military do to train soldiers in terms of mental health preparation. But I do know that on the way out, I don't think there's a lot of training in terms of how to re-enter civilian life,
yeah,
which is really where, you know, in my profession, we would like to see more emphasis played.
So like Gary was saying, we were talking earlier, that there needs to be some level of preparation for what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're finally making the exit, there needs to be some level of preparation for what's coming there as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
At least have the discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Gary, what do you think we need to improve on to help veterans and service members more?
I think the first thing we all recognized, my colleagues and I, as we joined together to write this book, was that it really does affect military service affects the entire family system, and that we have to look at it in terms of what is the motivation that leads people there, because, you know, again, as Susan was saying, we want to look and understand the entire social context of military service. And also, I think we need to be prepared of doing more research, like, how does this really affect fathers? How does it affect women with parenting their children and being away during multiple terms of deployment? I think we need to look at and do research on the military children and how are they coping, particularly those with losses. Another huge area I think we need to look at is that what about the amputees? And what about children's adjustment when the parent comes back who has PTSD, who's having, you know, a traumatic reaction in the home, how does that impact the children?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you both for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Susan McElvain, clinical social worker in the Cincinnati VA Medical Center PTSD Traumatic Brain Injury Residential Program, and Dr. Gary Dick, a therapist and professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Social Work and editor of the book Social Work Practice with Veterans. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. I'm Mark Caney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU. Earlier this month, the New York Stock Exchange suspended trading in its main market for almost 4 hours because of a technical problem, but it didn't have the same impact it would have had 20 years ago. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll look at how market trading takes place today. We'll also talk about the Anna Louise Inn, which has served single women in our community since 1909. That's on Cincinnati edition, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.